Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So tell me, Zoe, how did onion soup determine if a Viking lived or died?
Well, Bertie, what would happen is when they saw a Viking with a really bad wound in their torso, I guess you kind of want to call them like medics, but we all know that that's not the correct term. They're like herbalists or whatever, would concoct this incredibly pungent onion soup, and then they'd get the hurt Viking or warrior or whatever to ingest it. And what would happen is that as the soup worked its way down into the bowels and the stomach, if the bowels or the stomach were perforated anyway from the wound, you could smell it. So basically, if you could smell the onion soup, it meant that you had like mortal wounds and there wasn't much point in trying to save you. But if you had that pungent soup and they couldn't smell anything, they were like, great, we can actually give you herbs and stuff and like try and make you better.
And also, of course, you got a bowl of onion soup.
If you're going to go out, you want to go out with a nice meal in your stomach, you know? And onions are amazing, so it's a good meal overall.
Do you think it was tasty, that onion soup?
I mean, onions are pretty good. I assume they were cooked for a really long time over heat because it must have been cooked over like an open fire and stuff. So the onions would caramelize, and I assume they'd be in this kind of broth. So like, I don't think it would taste bad. I think you could smell it from a mile off, but I think it would have been okay.
So people would smell it and then they would look at Hjolnir or whatever this person was called and go like, I'm sorry, pal.
I'm sorry, you absolutely stink. So we're just going to like leave you here. But yeah, I think it still got you into Valhalla though if you died because of a battle wound. So they were probably kind of okay with it. But yeah.
Welcome to One to One, an interview podcast series where I, Bertie, a journalist at Eurogamer, talk to the brilliant people in and around the world of games. Today, someone I work alongside at Eurogamer, although they're someone much more recognisable than I am. They're someone who you'll see day in, day out if you follow the Eurogamer video team over on YouTube. Someone who delves into the lore of games, like Elden Ring, Resident Evil and God of War. And someone who always seems to be playing scary games. It's Zoe Delahunty-Light. Hi, Zoe. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Bertie. Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming on. So I always like at the beginning just to peer into people's lives because I'm nosy. I'm definitely that neighbour at the window with the blinds moving.
Little twitching blinds.
Yeah. And I like seeing kind of, you know, where people work and where they record from. So is this your studio area? Is this where you normally record from?
Calling it studio area is very kind of you, but it's actually just like a little nook in my front room. So I have like this, it's not a bay window, but like I have this little insert in my front room where like there's a light and window coming in, a window and light coming in even. But yeah, this is where I do all of my streaming from, and I just have a green screen up behind me. But not nearly as professional as to have a studio. I wish I had a studio, that'd be amazing.
One day, and you're sitting on what looks like, for people who are listening and not seeing this, you're sitting on a kind of, it looks like a Viking throne. It's like this fur, like an animal skin on the back of.
It's non-animal skin, I can say that. I don't support the use of fur, but it's like this. I wear a lot of black, Bertie. I consider myself a goth, but my chair is also black. So that means that when I used to stream, I would kind of just be like a floating head in an abyss.
which is great.
Which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but I kind of do like to be somewhat noticeable so people can see me as well as hear my scream. So I thought, why not chuck this fur thing over the back? And the added bonus, like you said, is it makes me look like I'm on a throne. So what's not to like?
Fantastic. I feel like you need big arm side bits.
Yeah, exactly. Made out of like a dark walnut stained oak or something, like right here.
Absolutely perfect. Yeah. So a throne next on a secret Santa throne. So what have I interrupted you doing today? This is kind of a glimpse into the life of Zoe. What have I interrupted?
Well, I was playing this amazing game called Dredge, which I love at the moment. So the embargo for it is next week at some point, but I've been playing it to kind of prepare myself for writing a video on it. But honestly, I got most of my work done for this week already. So yesterday I finished up my latest lore video. But all you interrupted me doing was just getting some good capture for Dredge. So didn't throw a massive spanner on the works, I'm sure you'll be relieved to hear.
Okay, so what kind of thing are you preparing for Dredge? So you're writing a script, what kind of script?
That's the whole thing. I can't really write scripts until I know what the title's going to be. It's just something I have with writing. Like, I find it really hard to write an entire script and then come up with a title. Like, the title gives me a massive sense of direction. So I'll be playing the game, and as I'm playing it, I'm trying to think of, like, listicles are really easy to write because people like that they're going into video being like, okay, cool, there are 9 things, so I know exactly what this video is going to give me. So I'm trying to think of, like, an aspect of Dredge that I can pull out for the title to try and hook and get people in at the moment. And then when the script's written, that then means I have to get capture for it. And something that always happens with scripts and capture, always, 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 is you'll have all this amazing capture that you've done, and then you'll forget that you've mentioned a really specific thing in the script that you inevitably never have footage of. So you have to go back and do it all over again. And it is such a pain in the behind.
Right, because obviously, as you're mentioning, you're trying to capture relevant sections of footage so people can watch those as you're talking. How long does it take you to kind of put together a script like that? Let's say a listicle, which is a list article or a list video for people who are not...
About 3 days, assuming I've played the game enough beforehand. If you're taking into account the amount of game I need to play, it's like a week at least.
Right, okay, so a week at least. And does that involve editing on the other side?
Yeah, that involves everything. On a good day, I can get a video done in 2 days if I'm not disturbed and if I'm completely, like, in the flow of writing and editing. But on those days when it's a bit harder to write and you've got this fiddly bit of capture to get and you've also got to do some extra VO, like, it can take 3 or 4 days to make a video just because there's so much, like, flotsam and jetsam around that you need to do to make sure it's right.
It's quite a lot of time, isn't it? I don't think people realise that when they're seeing the videos on YouTube as they're scrolling through. I don't think they realise that there's a chunky time investment that goes into making them.
I consider myself a very efficient person, and there's ways that I've come up with that I make the process a lot quicker for myself, which is very helpful. But I think people do definitely forget that not only are we essentially writing an article on this game, we then also have to voice it, we then have to find relevant capture that we have to get ourselves, no one gets it for us. We then have to edit that all together in a way that makes you engaged in the video. Like, it's basically like, I mean, you're a writer, Bertie. Imagine if you finished your article and you knew you were only 1/3 of the way done. Like, that feeling.
I'd quit, Zoe. It'd be too much.
Yeah, well, luckily I really like editing, so it's fine. But yeah, once you finish, I do think the script is the hardest thing to write, though, because I get quite bad writer's block sometimes. If you don't have a script, you're not getting a video, so you really need to push through to get that script done.
Yeah, which can be helpful when you know you have to push through, because it can help alleviate blockages, but it's also really crushes your head a little bit.
I always, like, save issues I have for my future self. So, like, if I can't get a script written, I'm like, well, I know I'm gonna get it written on time, so that's just a problem for my future self to deal with. And then my future self is like, oh my God, I'm under so much pressure. And under pressure, I really tend to thrive. So I'm like, oh my God, like, I'm completely in the zone now because I literally have to be to get a video done. But it doesn't happen all the time. But when it does, I know I can depend on my future self. And she probably hates me for saying that.
That's a great idea. I find sometimes, being in a rush helps produce some of the best things.
Yeah.
Often when you think you have a lot of time, you actually just make problems for yourself.
For sure.
In the long run. So we opened with us talking about onions, you talking about onion soup. Mm-hmm. Now, you know some interesting stuff about gruesome things, as we found out with that little story. And there's a whole load of this stuff on your TikTok, if anyone's following you. I learned about people being, this is going to sound gruesome, because it is, people being soaked in honey and sort of eating honey so that they could be eaten by other people after they'd died. I learned about Joan of Arc being burnt at the stake 3 times.
3 times. It's like, it's just like, to make sure.
It's like triple cooked chips. It's not like triple cooked chips.
If she was tasted just as succulent, although I guess no one ate her, so we never know, sadly. But
because she hadn't been eating honey and sexing
exactly,
honey.
Yeah.
And I learned about Alexander the Great's body not composing for days. So people were like, this guy's a saint. Mm-hmm. You know, let's make... There's loads, you know, all very cheery stuff to be talking about on a Friday morning.
Absolutely.
As we are. Where does all this information come from?
That's a great question, Bertie. Like, I read a lot of books about, like, death and decomposition and the way humanity's dealt with death for centuries, just because I find it an incredibly interesting topic. Like, there are these things called body farms where they just study how bodies decompose, which helps with, like, missing persons and identifying bodies and stuff. And I cannot tell you how much I want to visit a body farm. It's just because it's, like, it's this bit of our essential human existence that unless you're unfortunate and you, like, find a body or something, you never really get to see. And I think the big thing is that, like, unless you're a literal murderer, you never get the choice to see it. It's never, like, an option that's presented to us. So I've always been really interested in, like, what happens to the body after death, how different cultures deal with death. But, like, I read a lot of books by, like, mortuary assistants, a lot of books by doctors, like, by historians and stuff, just because I want to know what happens to the body. And because I'm not going to go down that dark side of the internet, it's very hard to, like, actually see that kind of stuff. So I just also, like, sometimes I'm just curious, like, I just Google, like, you know, about the plague, and I'll read the entire Wikipedia page and then, like, go down a rabbit hole of, like, all the things that's cited and stuff.
Or a rat hole,
yeah, more likely. But it's just, it's hard saying where any one thing comes from, because I just find something interesting and then I'll remember later and be like, this is a fun fact to tell people on the internet.
But yeah, right. I got an inkling of this when I think I'd watched you play The Mortuary Assistant, which is a game that came out last year, where you play a mortuary assistant, but there's some demonic stuff going on as well.
Yeah.
So it's really good. I really liked it. And I thought, oh, it's great. And I'll play it. And I remember talking to you about this, and we had this conversation that kind of suddenly got a lot broader and a lot deeper about the sort of dignity of being a mortuary assistant. And, you know, preparing people for death. And I got an inkling then into, you know, the way you think about things. And it's interesting because death is a huge part of our obsession as human beings, right? We're obsessed about it, but trying to dodge it, trying to defy it. And in the West, particularly, I think it's a bit of a taboo, right? We don't really talk about it. Whereas I think in the East, it's more talked about, I think, generally, and kind of and celebrated. And you touched on some of the kind of reasons why, but you're interested in it. But do you remember where this fascination kind of came from and when it began, when you noticed
it? So when I was younger, I was flicking TV channels and I ended up for a brief second on this vet show. And I landed on the exact time when they cut a hamster's stomach open and all of the intestines came out. And, like, I only saw it for a second before I was like, oh, I don't think I want to see that. But I've always remembered that one shot, and I think it was that, like, sudden exposure to, like, what you're not kind of supposed to see, or what our culture tells us we're not supposed to see, more accurately, that kind of made me, like, have this fascination with what it actually looks like. So, like, I also kind of just, I really think that dead bodies deserve a lot more respect than we give them, and in order to respect dead bodies, you have to know about them. And, like, it's not really fair to be like, that's gross, so I don't want to know about it. I understand why people think that, obviously, but, like, I think from a more, like, empathetic side, people don't stop mattering just because they're dead. So, like, when they're dead, they deserve to have that kind of, like, to know what's happening to them. Obviously you can't tell them, but, like, I mean, from a more, like, philosophical point of view, I just feel like it's that final, like, sign of kindness and empathy to, like, take care of a dead body, even though, like, the body doesn't care. It's more like, I just think it's, like, essential respect. But yeah, I think the hamster is where it all started.
So you saw this hamster and at this point, were you like, right, that's it, I'm becoming a goth?
Yes, basically. I've always been, like, fascinated, well, because I like death and stuff, I also really like the kind of stuff that, well, like, witch things, occult stuff, pagan kind of celebrations, Wicca. I've always been really fascinated with that, just because, like, it makes me happy. Like, it's the equivalent of seeing, like, pink stuff and being happy. Like, goth stuff just makes me happy. But, like, for a long period when I was kind of a teenager going into a young adult, only recently I've kind of allowed myself to be interested in, like, goth culture again and, like, becoming a goth, because I was shamed out of it a lot by, like, my school and stuff. Which is sad, because, like, I just think it's really sad to make, like, cringe culture, you know? Like, cringe culture's dead. I don't think it's fair to make people feel, like, call them cringy for liking certain things, which is unfortunately what happened to me. But I just, goth stuff is just willing to deal with the death stuff. It's willing to, like, talk about it. And not even in a, like, sometimes people are like, oh, spooky death. But other times people are just like, I just think goth culture acknowledges death as a thing. And that you don't have to kind of go through life trying to ignore it, like it actively kind of embraces that darker side.
Yeah.
Although even calling it a darker side of life isn't really true, because it's not a darker side of life. It's life. Like, it's just a bit of life, you know?
So I mentioned that you play a lot of scary games or scarier games. Do you think the two things went hand in hand? Because we're talking about a darker side and you know, I suppose there's a kind of correlation. But did that pull you towards scarier games, do you think?
So I'm a massive scaredy cat, Bertie. Like, I would not play horror games before I started at Eurogamer. Eurogamer is what, like, has kind of made me better at doing scary games, because I just would not play them. And if I did, like, in Bioshock, I was so scared I wouldn't step out of the bathysphere at the beginning.
Oh my god, me too!
I couldn't get out of it. And then when I did, I'd move, like, an inch every minute or something, because I was terrified of what would come next.
Super atmospheric, that game.
So good. I love Bioshock so much. But yeah, it's only really starting at Eurogamer, because my reactions to horror games are funny to watch, because I'm so scared. That I've not become desensitized to them, but I've become a lot braver when dealing with them, like, knowing that a scare is coming and being okay with that, instead of being like, oh my god, I don't know what's coming next.
And but... I think there's something about the idea that people are watching you play as well, that makes, would make me braver to do it, whereas just playing on my own, I'm like, oh,
absolutely. So when I was younger, I didn't have access to games consoles, so instead I'd watch really long let's plays and, like, walkthroughs on YouTube. Well, like, no commentary walkthroughs on YouTube were my first exposure to gaming as a thing, and I'd always watch the horror games, like Dead Space. I did Bioshock. I did oh god, what is it, the one where the guy, like, screams, Condemned, Criminal Origins, that's it. I watched a lot of that, like, all the horror games I'd watch, because I knew, number one, physically couldn't play them myself, number two, mentally couldn't play them myself. So, like, watching someone else did it, it's like, I really want to know about horror games when I was younger, but I couldn't, because I couldn't make myself do it. But watching someone else play it was fine, because it was just like a really long movie. But I've always been fascinated by that stuff. I, like, had the Silent Hill Wikipedia bookmarked, and I just read all the entries, like, over and over again. That was, like, my bedtime reading for, like, years and years and years.
What's the scariest game that you've played? Which game unsettled you the most?
Resident Evil 7 was terrifying. I think it's a fantastic horror game, but that game was like,
that's the one with the house.
Yes, I think the first half was the most terrifying. I didn't really like the bit after the tanker, but I think that was the most terrifying, just because it was so sad and, like, kind of different. Like, I think if PT had come out, that would be the most scary, but Resident Evil 7 is what proper, like, that's the scariest game I've played so far, I think.
So do you feel yourself kind of pulled towards scary games now in a way that you weren't perhaps before?
Yeah, definitely. I feel more like, the reason I think I really like scary games is because there's so much, if they're good scary games, there's so much more going on in them. Like, I always think the stories of horror games have a capacity to be so much more interesting than games that aren't horror, because they're willing to deal with, like, uncomfortable subjects.
Yeah.
Like, until it kind of went off the rails and I didn't like it, I thought Outlast, the first one, was really interesting, because it actually dealt with, like, it had that concept of, you would have NPCs around who were in the asylum, but they wouldn't attack you, they would just be doing their own thing. And, like, in Dead Space, when you meet that guy, he's just banging his head against the wall, like, that kind of horror that was willing to be like, not everything out here is to get you, and we can scare you in more ways than just having something trying to kill you. Like, I think when people try to come up for reasons with that existing in any kind of media, their explanations for it in the story are so interesting, because they're then allowed to be like, okay, what terrible thing happened that I'm allowed to talk about now because it caused this ripple effect? It's,
So, we mentioned some of the videos you do and, you know, a lot of the reading you do, and I can hear it kind of in the way that you're speaking. There's this, your mind seems to be kind of looking for an explanation, you know, wanting to find deeper things. Is this what you think you're, where you think your fascination over lore comes from, perhaps.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
I've always loved, it's why I love Wikipedia, and specifically Wikipedia for video games, because there's always someone who's like typed up every single text note, every single dialogue, every single little thing you can find in the game. It's always on there. So when I'm trying to find explanations for things, it rewards you for being that like anal about it as I am, or like finding this one bit of loot that's dropped by this enemy that you'd never see anywhere else in the game. But it's definitely where my interest in lore comes from, because I love being able to like look at the bigger picture and then zoom into like incredibly specific details like item descriptions, and then to be like, oh, that makes sense why this now happened because of this tiny thing. And I think it's one of the rare things where like there are so many different types of people who play games, but for the ones who just like the experience, I think it can be really cool for them to then go on YouTube or whatever and see a lore video and be like, oh yeah, I'd love to know more about this like monster that beat my ass 5 times, you know? Like, and I think especially with FromSoft games, they really do like, they encourage that kind of curiosity in their players. Like, they just don't tell you stuff, so you do have to really work to find it. But yeah, it's why I really like, I'm really interested in true crime as well, because trying to find the answers and trying to find, again, it goes back to the death stuff. Like, it's just trying to find answers and like clarification and stuff like that.
Yeah, I'm a big true crime fan as well. We've been talking a little bit about podcasts and things. I'm a sucker for them. I especially love the, they always start with, well, not always, but a lot of them start with something gruesome happening, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is what kicks it off. But it's the process after that that fascinates me. It's the process of digging into it and unraveling it and hopefully coming to a new conclusion. But talking of true crime, I noticed actually you started briefly a true crime series on YouTube about... I've got it written down. Oh, who put Bella in the witch elm?
Yeah.
What's
yeah,
that?
Oh my God. I actually have another video coming up on that channel that I've been working on for like a year with research for it. But it's with the stuff on my personal channel, I only want to cover like who put Bella in the witch elm, true crime from before 1950. Because
Okay.
the reporting on crime before 1950 is so different from what we see nowadays. Like, in some respects it's the same, like the sensationalism, but there's not that glorification of the serial killer or the killer afterwards. Unlike, I mean, Jack the Ripper's the obvious exception. But I really want to dive into the stories of these like women who have been killed and then like massively forgotten. It's really, really sad. But with Who Put Bella in the Witch Elm, I've always like known about it, because I mean, just that phrase and knowing it was on like a plinth is like, that's like real life horror. That's really like folk horror stuff. And then like the more you dig into it and the more you investigate it, you just find all these things that were done kind of incorrectly, and it's so frustrating. Like, do you know Bella's body was like given to the medical examiner like as a gift, essentially? Like, it wasn't like preserved, it wasn't buried, like it was just given to this medical examiner who then gave it to a university, and now it's lost. And it's like, this was a woman. Like, how could you do that? Like, it's absolutely shocking.
I love this. I love the whole idea of, because there's a lot going on here. You go back in the past, but you're, you know, talking about how women were dealt with back in that time as well, how crime was dealt with also, while, you know, unraveling an engaging story as well. So this, can you say anything about this one that you've been working on and when it's
I would love to tell you everything about it, Bertie. So it's about not the story, but what happened to Bridget Cleary, who was a woman who was set alight in her home in Ireland because her husband was convinced she was a fairy.
Oh my
so
God.
Okay. It's an incredibly interesting and sad tale of this. So I might get a bit loud here because it really makes me fucking angry. But this incredibly independent, smart, intelligent, ambitious woman who was making her own way in the world. She had a feather in her hat because she owned hens. So she loved her hens. So she would always seem with like a feather in her hat, and she'd sell eggs. And because she was this kind of independent woman, there was so much going on with her and her husband with like, because of the gender roles in the 1920s, he was obviously quite insecure about her independence and her going off to be a seamstress, which was like a massive step up for her family. So all of this kind of insecurity that he had, and then at the same time, this is when there was a lot of English, like, invasion of Ireland. Like, English were basically just being dicks, as per usual, with Ireland, which is disgusting. But there was a lot of kind of tumultuous stuff going on around that, and, like, in particular, the policing system. And it meant that the local Irish culture of, like, knowing about folk stories and folk beliefs and stuff like that was dying out. So when the husband was like, my wife is acting weird because she was sick, this old dude, I think his name was John Dunn, he then used that opportunity to then be like, oh, well, she might, you know, be one of the Fae or something. Because they had this idea with changelings that, like, they steal away the real human and they replace it with a fairy. And then, because fairies don't like fire and iron, if you burn them, the real one will come back. But because there was this massive exodus of Irish knowledge and folk knowledge and culture that was kind of being, like, talked down and, like, ridiculed by the English, it meant that this other guy, John Dunn, was so, like, he wasn't being respected, basically. Like, he knew all this stuff about Irish culture and, like, their beliefs and stuff, and he was now being treated like a idiot by people who were, like, by the English people, essentially, by the English. So when he found this one moment where he could, like, I don't know what to phrase it, but, like, he was suddenly being paid attention to by this woman's husband, by Bridget's husband. It was like he then took that and ran with it. Like, he was suddenly the one that, like, knew everything about the Fae. And, like, it all culminates in Bridget being burned alive, which is absolutely fucking horrific. And then her husband going to a fairy mound to try and find the real her. And, like, it's very debatable whether he actually believed she was a fairy or not, or whether he was just doing this to try and cover his tracks. But not only is that event itself fascinating and so sad, but there's also, because the trial was very highly publicized, both in Ireland and England, there are transcripts of what exactly happened in the court. So you can hear what happened, not only from the murderer, but from Bridget's dad, from the woman who was nearby, from their neighbors. It's like an incredible, almost full picture of what happened in this tiny cottage in Ireland. But it's taken like a year of research because I've read every book on it. Like, I'm learning how to use software to, like, present it in a 3D kind of, like, visual style. So because we know exactly what the cottage looked like, but poor Bridget Cleary. But yeah, that's the next thing I'm doing, and I could talk about it for, like, hours, Bertie. But that was
fascinating. I can't wait to hear the whole story. So when can I hear the whole story?
This year at some point. I'm literally teaching myself how to use Unity so I can, like, make a video on it. So it's very involved, but it's those kinds of stories that are so interesting, though, because, like, who knows about Bridget Cleary now? Exactly. No one. Everyone's focused on, like, Ted Bundy and, like, Scott Peterson, and it's not fair that these women are forgotten. And especially that someone who was as smart and intelligent and ambitious as Bridget Cleary was forgotten. And the cliff notes for her story is her husband thought her was a fairy. Like, she was so much, much more than her death. So yeah, I get very passionate when I talk about women being forgotten like that, because it's just so unfair and not on.
It is unfair, and rightly so. So we'll look out for that on your, that's your own channel, your private.
My YouTube channel, Zoe Dales, yes.
YouTube channel. Okay, so let's jump a second, and let's talk a bit about your route into games.
Yes.
And how you got here. So let's go way back to little Zoe, who I imagine was a bit like Wednesday Addams.
Yeah, that's fair to assume. That's very fair to assume.
So what did you want to be back then when you grew up? Did you have an initial sort of dream?
I really wanted to be an architect.
Okay.
But then I realised that that required maths, so I didn't follow that. But you know, when you're younger, I always wanted to be like an author or an artist or something. But it was always something to do with like writing, because I read ferociously as a child, like all the time. I'd read like Green Penguins and stuff at the age of 8, because I was like thirsty for like more books and I could never really get quite enough. But yeah, it started off as like an author or an artist or something, and then as I got older,
the arts continued, hasn't it? Sorry to interrupt, because you still do drawing, you still do some artwork. In fact, brief tangent, I've noticed that you have a shop, a digital shop, not a kind of opening soon. What's happening there? What's that about?
So House of Mugwort is my own brand / shop that I'm so excited about. It's at the moment, it's going to be selling kind of some of the extras I have from my Kickstarter campaign about hard enamel pins. But I'm talking to like clothes manufacturers and stuff, because I want to start designing clothes and like sell them and have my designs on them and stuff. But I think I've always kind of wanted to own a small business, and the fact that it will give me a kind of creative outlet is just like the icing on the cake, because I love writing, I love editing, but I also love drawing and creating. So I want to do something with that kind of hobby that I have.
Yeah, and I've noticed there's a bit of activity recently around kind of promoting the shop. It feels like the shop is maybe opening soon. When is that happening?
In the next couple of weeks, really. I need to send off the last of my Kickstarter orders and then it'll be open. So end of February, I think it'll be open.
Wow, exciting. So yeah. And what can people find there? So I saw something maybe about tarot cards.
Yes, so they can find postcards of my 3 tarot cards that I've designed, art prints, these like pouches with a sword kind of like printed on them with some birds, loads of hard enamel pins that are like witchy and neurodivergent and goth, stickers, all of the above. Oh, and like tiny notebooks as well that I have designed.
Lovely.
Yeah.
You mentioned swords there. I know you've got a thing for swords. I think you have a tattoo of a sword somewhere.
I do, right here. Sword here and a dagger here.
Nice.
And then I have a lady holding a sword as well.
Very nice.
I love swords.
We can see you've got a little sword on the wall.
Yes. I have Leviathan over here, which is an axe. And I also have like 3 sword openers and a sword hairpin. Like, I just love swords. What can I say?
Fantastic. Okay. Tangent aside. At what point do games come into your life?
When I was in secondary school... No, when I was in primary school, I used to play Harry Potter and Philosopher's Stone with my dad on the computer all the time. I'll just make it very clear. I think J.K. Rowling is a TERF. I can't stand her. I think she's a dick and I don't like Harry Potter because of her involvement in it. But I did used to play that as a child.
Yeah.
And then when I was in secondary school, a friend of mine introduced me to a game called Akami and Bioshock, which kind of like started my interest in it again. And then as I grew into a teenager, I'd start watching those long form walkthroughs on YouTube about games and going on the Wikipedias. And it just kind of all like expanded and grew from there. And then when I was at university, I became the editor of the lifestyle and culture section of the university newspaper.
Right. What did you do at university?
University of Leeds.
And what were you studying?
English. Language and literature. Yeah. I started a video game column in the university newspaper because I was like, I need to do something about this thing that I'm interested in. And then everything just kind of blew up from there in a good way.
So at what point do you first make a video about games?
The first time I made a video about games was when I was at Games Radar.
Right, so you were already there and then...
Yeah, I had watched loads of videos about gaming and stuff. And I had kind of like... I always knew I wanted to know how to make videos, but I didn't know how. Like, I knew that I had the ability to. So when I was at Games Radar, I was constantly like, hey, I want to learn about video. Hey, I want to learn about video. And eventually, James Jarvis, who was the head of video there at the time, I don't know what he's doing now, but he eventually taught me how to use Premiere Pro. And then I got pretty good at Premiere Pro and like started to make videos for ad campaigns and about whether we're too used to death in video games, I think, was one that really blew up on the channel. But it was just through like constant persistence and stubbornness and stuff that I taught myself how to use Premiere Pro, because I had such like a vivid image of what I wanted videos to be like and like what I wanted to cover, because articles are great and amazing, but I've always wanted to like have visuals to match what my writing and stuff. So the videos only really started when I was at Games Radar. I always wanted to start a YouTube channel when I was a teenager, but I was too scared of like the feedback, and I was scared of being on camera, and I had like played some online games with my brother and the response to my voice as a woman was never great. So I always had this intense fear of being on camera and like putting myself out there. But once I got to Games Radar, I'd grown in confidence and I was like, you know what, I have interesting opinions and I'm good at writing, so I'm gonna make videos.
So how was it when you did put yourself out there? Because that is... Yeah, I understand why you
scary.
Were.
Yeah, so I wrote this script for like the most terrifying Silent Hill creatures there were. And I didn't really play any of the games. Like, I knew the ones I was talking about because I was obsessed with them, would like watch all the boss fights and read the Wikipedia pages and everything. But as a result, the bosses that I picked apparently weren't from like the most beloved Silent Hill games, which people got really pissed off about, even though I was talking about the boss design. So I made this video on it and I voiced it and everything. And the comments were just like horrible. Like, one of them was like, they were all about how I was wrong, obviously. Then the other one said my delivery was incorrect. And then for like the next couple of videos, I really just did this monotone voice. I was trying to sound as like masculine as possible, which looking back at it now really sucks. I was trying to essentially conceal the fact that I was a woman. But then with time, like, my confidence grew and grew and grew. And once I heard my voice back on stuff, I started to notice how I was speaking and then be like, okay, well, I'm now going to start actually speaking like a someone who's because when you're reading scripts, you have to put so much more effort in because faces communicate so much and you do not have my face. So it just has to be all through the mouth. But the first video was absolutely terrifying and really horrible. But then after that, I think I was just like, I got thicker skin and I was like, fuck them, I'm done. I'm going to say my opinions.
So how do you end up at Eurogamer? Because you've been at Eurogamer it's getting on for 4 years now.
A long time.
So how do you get to Eurogamer?
So I first got my job at GamesRadar as an online editorial graduate, which meant I was basically like, not a dog's body, but like I was like doing a bit of everything at GamesRadar, which then turned into features writer, which then turned into like video producer slash features writer, and kind of went back and forth between videos and features because I was really good at headlines. So my features always did really well, but I wanted to do video, but they wanted me writing features because I always got them clicks, which is never a bad thing. But eventually got to the point where I was like, I'm fed up of being like torn between these two things. I just want to do video because I think I can be really good at it if I do it full time. And Johnny had just left Eurogamer, and before then I'd gone for some interviews to be on RPS's YouTube channel.
Okay.
But it wasn't the right fit, so I didn't end up pursuing that. But the HR guy at Gamer Network remembered me from all my interviews and from the feedback and stuff. So when the Eurogamer role came up, I emailed Aoife just to be like, hi, I'm Zoe. Here's videos I've made. Here's my CV. Like, I'd love to talk to you about this role you have going. And she got back to me and she was amazing as per usual. And then that kind of got the ball rolling about getting me into the office. And because I was so motivated, I so wanted the job. I was like, I can start immediately. Like, I can move and like just do everything. Like, my parents have a house in Chichester, so I was like, I can live there and like I can come and commute in. I was just doing anything I could to get the job because I was like, this is what I want to do, like, completely. And luckily, Aoife and Ian really liked me. I mentioned like toast and zombies and stuff in like our test Let's Play we did, and Aoife was like, as soon as you said something about like toast just being bread zombies, I knew you were weird enough for the team. So I was like, that's sick, great. And then I started, and it's just been incredible. Like, it's exactly, you know, when you find exactly what you want to do and you're like, yes, this is it. Like, this fulfills me in all these different ways and I love it. Yeah,
so that's lovely. I love hearing people's origin stories.
Origin story.
In this way, so it's been 4 years. Do you have any standout memories in that 4 years? That's not quite 4 years, but almost.
Yeah, I remember there's so many memories. Like, one of my most vivid ones is when we were doing a reaction stream to the BAFTA nominations one year, and I started to talk about, there was this game, I think it's Concrete Genie it might be called. But it was like art in a city landscape, and this, the main characters are being bullied. And I started to talk about it, and like before the stream I was like, oh yeah, this game looks cool, but I wasn't like, oh, this game is my identity. But once I started to talk about the game and art and bullying, I started to cry, and I was like, where has this come from? Like, what therapy do I need? But that was just a really vivid memory because I was like, it took me by surprise, and I think it took Aoife and Ian by surprise as well, because they were like, we've never seen her be this emotional about a game. But apart from that, my other vivid memory is we were playing Resident Evil 7 for our Halloween horror stream in like my first year or something. And I had agreed to go in VR in Resident Evil 7 if we got to a certain amount of money. And I literally couldn't move. I was so scared. Like, I was just in the headset. And like, I think the comments could see that. I was like, I am about to shit myself. Like, I couldn't move. I couldn't look around. My body just froze. So yeah, that was memorable as well. I'd say those are my two most memorable moments on Eurogamer.
Oh, lovely. so in those 4 years as well, you know, this is... you had done some videos before, but this is you know, full-time doing videos for nearly 4 years. What's that been like, kind of working very much in the public eye like that, and, you know, having people recognize you, having a certain amount of celebrity? Is there a kind of pressure there? Because I think it's often easier to be invisible than it is visible.
Yeah, but I've always kind of, I spent so much of my life being scared about what people think of me because of various reasons, like because I was a goth, because I was a woman on like videos and stuff at Games Radar, because like I didn't really speak my mind when I was younger at all. I was always kind of like a people pleaser. It kind of got to the point where I was just like, I don't think I care anymore. And like, I've grown in confidence in my own sense of self and self-worth and stuff, that now that I'm in the public eye a bit more, I find it freeing almost, because it's like, I'm confident in being myself now. And I know that some of the stuff I like tweet and say like isn't really ever what people quite expect from me, because I think I'm really blunt. So it's actually been quite liberating to see people respond to that in a positive way. And although like I don't, you know, I think everyone wants to be anonymous every now and again, like I always love meeting people who know me in real life, because it like there's this one commenter called Claire T-Rex, and when I met her in real life at EGX, I was like, oh my god, you're famous, because like I had seen her name so often everywhere. I was like, oh my god, it's you. Like, it was exciting for me to meet her, because it was like, oh my god. But yeah, it's never been like a bad thing for me to get recognized in public, just because I really like, I can then talk to the person and I know what I can talk to them about and be like, oh hey, how are you? And you always know that like just being like yourself with someone outside of video and like outside of YouTube, it can be a really special moment for the other person as well. So I love knowing that I'm hopefully making people happy in real life. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And I admire, because some of the things you talk about as well, like neurodivergency, LGBTQIA plus rights, you know, representation, those kind of things as well. I don't know, do you see or ever feel yourself as a spokesperson for those things? Or is it just a happy side effect of who you are?
I never think that's my like intention. Like, I don't think I'm the person to be a voice for like certain queer subjects, because I don't have any direct experience of them. So like, it's like I don't feel like I have the expertise to talk about and become a spokesperson. I just think the louder people are about stuff they believe in, especially when it's for people who don't have voices themselves and like public platforms and stuff, the more that it's harder for people to ignore them and for to ignore the issues that they're facing to go away and stuff. I think with like my autism stuff, I just want to be open about who I am. Mm. Like, for a very long time, my psychiatrist was like, you know, you don't have to like, people don't have to know you're autistic, like if you're uncomfortable with that. But when something explains who you are and how you behave and how you see the world so clearly, not like holding that piece of you back, it never felt right to me, because it was like, it's really hard to explain, but it would be like hiding the fact I'm bisexual. Like, it just wouldn't feel right. Like, I want to be myself, and part of myself is being autistic. So like, if people don't like it, they can get in the bin. I'm going to be honest about it. Yeah.
So I have to ask, what you do is a very sought after, I think, from young people, is a sought after role, you know. I don't think, partly because they don't understand, I don't think, all of the work that goes into it. But if you have a piece of advice to young people or anyone who looks at what you do and wants to do it too, if you had a piece of advice to them, what would that be?
Find out what you like making, and don't try and make someone else's content. And that's not being shady and being like, don't copy people. It's being more like, if you want to get a job in the industry and you want to be noticed, you do have to be doing something a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. So it took a really long time for me to start making lore videos, because I was like, no one's going to care. Like, no one's going to be interested in them, even though I really loved doing it and I thought it was interesting. And I did do it. The response was great. So it's like you have to, because the game space on YouTube has especially become so oversaturated, in order to like make people take notice of you nowadays, is very different what you have to do, like in contrast to what you have to do in 2012. So you do have to kind of be a little bit different and also like have enough passion for that to come across in the video. Also, pay attention to your thumbnails. Your thumbnails are really important for YouTube. So like that is what gets people hooked in. So you want to have people hooked in and then you want to reward them for watching your video. So don't like do clickbait or anything. Just give the people what they want and try not to like... it's really hard to sum up like what I tell myself if I was younger, which is essentially what I'm trying to frame this as. But it's more just like, if you don't have the confidence to do it and you're scared like I was, there's a lot more going on than just like, I'm not confident enough to go on video. Like, it's about your sense of self and stuff. So you need to find that one thing that makes you be like, I don't fucking care what other people say. Like, I know this like inside out and I know I can talk about it like lore. So I'm going to do it. You know, it's like armor almost, like when you know stuff on the internet, because God knows people like to use other things against you.
Good advice. Yeah. So we're nearly at the end. But before we finish, there are a few questions that I like to ask everyone. Three questions. The first of these is first game. What was the first game you played? And this can be the literal first or the first significant game in your life.
I'm going to go with Skyrim.
Really?
Because Skyrim was the first game I bought. I bought it on a whim, first of all. Like, I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know what, like, a first-person game was. I didn't know what an RPG was. I was just like, I've seen this game on YouTube. Like, I've seen people talking about it. I've seen the adverts. I'm going to buy this on the 360 because I think it looks like it could be fun. Like, I literally didn't know what I was going into at all. And then I spent an entire summer, day in, day out, in this one tiny room in our house with a screen that was, like, this big. It was, like, 30 centimetres by 15 centimetres, playing Skyrim nonstop. Like, I would play 12-hour days, go to sleep, wake up, play Skyrim, like, on this tiny TV. And it just completely, like, engulfed me. And it was, like... You know, you see that meme of like the brain explosion thing. Like, it was like that for me. It was like, oh my God, this is what an open world RPG is. And it was by far the most influential game I've ever played, because it was like seeing in color for the first time. It was like, this is what gaming is. I understand why people are like so obsessed with it now.
Wow.
So Skyrim. Yeah.
Fond memories of Skyrim becoming a vampire lord.
Yes. But I was always kind of annoyed that that everyone then attacked you when you're a vampire lord. I was like, just let me live and kill you. But
let
don't
me live,
me.
Let me have a castle somewhere and then, you know, recruit.
Let me have an awesome vampire form that I can't see properly because I'm in first person, which is annoying. I don't like being in third person, but yeah, love being a vampire.
So the second of these questions is last game. And I think we've covered this, but what was the last game you were playing?
The last game I was playing was Dredge, which I'm playing at the moment.
And what is Dredge?
It's amazing, Bertie. That's what it is. It's a horror fishing game. So
wow.
You can see trailers for it online, but you're like a little teeny tiny, like, not a ship, but, you know, like a boat that's just fishing. And there are these towns that require you to, like, catch, you know, certain amount of fish for them, and, like, you sell fish. And then with that money, you can upgrade your ship and you can buy more fishing rods. But every now and again, you just reel up like something really weird and not quite right. And like at night, when night falls, you get panicked and you can see some stuff in the distance that doesn't look right. And you can see these vague shapes chasing your ship around. Like, it's really good, like really good. And like stuff will attack your ship in the middle of the night and something slithers into your hold. Like, it's very... Oh, it's just so good. I love it so much. Like, I cannot wait for people to give it a go. But I've been playing Dredge. So yeah, that's my
answer.
That
sounds great.
It's
okay.
So good.
The third of these questions, the last one. Best game or favorite game?
Oh, God.
It's a horrible question. But
Bertie, you're so mean. Why would you ask me this?
Sorry. What comes to mind when you think, what best game? What's my favorite game? There's normally
the
a few
is,
that just...
I feel like when you say this, when people ask this question, you'll say your immediate response, and then that's like a response that comes from the heart. And then your brain will be like, well, it's not really that good of a game, is it?
Doesn't
like,
matter if it's good.
Go wrong with it.
Doesn't matter.
I would say the first game that springs to mind is Akami, because I love Akami. I replayed it recently, and it wasn't the same, because it never is. But the first time I played it, I was engulfed in that game for ages, and I love Akami. But I'd probably have to say Bioshock. Bioshock was the one game where that game is saturated. Like, there's backstory, there's lore, there's tiny characters you can find out about. The design of the game itself, like the, the actual environments is stunning and beautiful. Mm. It was scary and sad. Like, the splices are such a fantastic idea that I don't think anyone's ever really topped, apart from maybe Necromorphs. Like, the central story in it, all the players that were fully fleshed out and realized, the concept of a city under the sea and being able to visit it after its heyday. Like, Bioshock just has it all. Like, it's one of the very rare games which I feel like I could step into and I'd believe in it for everything that was happening, because everything was so solid. And I've read the books about Bioshock, so you know I'm really dedicated if I've read the actual books they've written about it. But yeah, also Fable, actually, all the Fable games. Fable 2 is my favorite one, but I love Fable. It's a very comfort game for me. And it's why I feel good about stretch marks, because, you know, in Fable, when you get magic, you get like these like marks on your face that are like your skin splitting.
Oh, yeah.
Like with blue. So that looks really similar to the stretch marks I have over my body. So now when I see my stretch marks, I'm like, oh, I'm like magic from Fable. And it like genuinely makes me feel really good about my body. So I love Fable.
Exciting times with a new Fable in development, of course.
Yeah, please give us some news about that, Playground Games, if you're listening to this. Please tell me something about it.
I worry when we don't hear about it.
Oh, me too. But I want
also it. With Ken Levine's new game, Judas.
I have this like inherent dislike of sci-fi stuff, so it takes a lot for me to get interested in it. But the very fact it's in space, I'm already like, oh my god, not space. But I'm just being prejudicial and should give it a go.
Zoe, you have been brilliant. Thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Thank you for having me. It's been delightful to talk to you always as Bertie.
Thank you. To everyone listening or watching, please drop us a lovely review if you like the show, and subscribe to hear more episodes. I'm Bertie. That was 1-to-1, and I'll see you all in a couple of weeks. Bye for now.